You are listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. This is Jorge Fascinetti. Welcome. Today, we are talking about pituitary surgery with a neurosurgeon who is considered one of, if not the most, successful pituitary surgeon in the world today. He performs over 170 pituitary surgeries with the highest cure rates and the lowest complication rates that are published. I am thrilled to have had the opportunity to have this chat with him and share it with all of you. Dr. Sandeep Pooner is a neurosurgeon with a special interest in pituitary tumors, included craniopharyngiomas. He uses minimally invasive surgical technique to treat patients with these disorders. He cares for pediatric patients in collaboration with a pediatric neurosurgery team. Dr. Kunwar earned his medical degree at UCSF, where he also completed an internship and a residency. As a Howard Hughes Medical Institute research scholar, he worked in the laboratory of molecular biology at the National Cancer Institute. The first time I met Dr. Kunwar, we talked about my tumor a short month before my surgery. He was incredibly reassuring and projected a calmness and competence that was truly remarkable. I knew he was an outstanding surgeon with a stellar reputation, but I really didn't know much about pituitary surgery then, or really what made a great pituitary surgeon. All I can tell you is that when he was done explaining and describing the operation, I had no doubt in my mind that I was in the care of one of the best in the business. We talked a few weeks ago in his clinic at the University of California, San Francisco Center for Pituitary Disorders. Dr. Kunwar, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
Just love to see you.
That's always good seeing you as
well. Good to see you. So let me start by asking you, did you know you always wanted to be a surgeon when you started medical school, or was that a decision you made as your studies progressed?
Yeah, so actually it turns out I was actually interested in neurosurgery in high school. One of my old high school friends I ran into and they were asking me about this. So it's been a long-standing process, but I think initially it was more the cool factor of being a brain surgeon, but I've always been interested in memory and how we record memory, and so the brain was always fascinating. That's why when I went to college, I actually studied neurobiology, but it became very clear in medical school that neurosurgery was going to be the path I was going to take.
Yeah, some of the new studies on neuropsychology are fascinating.
Yeah.
And the way they're using the brain to study how people respond to certain things.
That's translating, of course, into artificial intelligence now, because the more we can understand the brain, the more we can understand how we program things, which in fact is getting a little scary.
Yeah.
But there's so much we still don't understand about how memory is processed and how we kind of remember even 2 + 2 = 4, for example.
Yeah.
But so that's still an ongoing interest.
It's fascinating. It really is, because there's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
But how did you decide to go into the specialty of pituitary surgery?
Well, so neurosurgery became pretty clear because I'd like to be hands-on, I like to fix things, identify problems and find solutions for them. I also thought about things like cardiothoracic surgery, but again, my interest in the brain led me to neurosurgery. But then I had the good fortune of actually doing a seminar with on brain oncogenes and the development of how cancer develops. And it was taught by Michael Bishop, who the following year got the Nobel Prize. And
Wow.
It really interested me in brain tumors.
Yeah.
And so my focus initially was starting on brain tumors. And I had I trained with Charlie Wilson, who really showed and really kind of expanded the field of pituitary surgery and showing that it can be effective and safe and cure should be the goal, and safety has got to always be the highest priority.
Yeah.
And so when I started working with him, I became fascinated by neuroendocrinology and pituitary surgery itself, and then it sort of evolved from there.
And I'm assuming it's a field that it's constantly developing and learning as you go, you learn new things with new techniques and new...
Yeah,
we'll ask you about that a little
later.
Yeah,
and there's no question from when I started this in really 1999 when I took over Dr. Wilson's practice to now, things have evolved and changed significantly.
Yeah.
And even before he passed away, talking to Dr. Wilson about the new changes. He was even amazed and excited about that his work is continuing on and expanding.
I read a lot about him because we run on Pituitary World News, we run a story about him.
Yeah.
And I had the chance to do a little research. He was a character, wasn't he?
He was a big character.
Yeah. You studied under him. So
I did.
So tell me a little bit about him. What made him so... Because he was one of the pioneers in transphenoidal surgery, right?
He was. I mean, you know, the operation started with Harvey Cushing. It kind of left the U.S. for a while. This is back in the 1940s. And then... individuals like Gerard Guillot and Norman Dodd continued it in Europe, and it didn't come back to North America until Jules Hardy brought it back in. Otherwise, it pretty much shut down in the U.S. In the U.S.
Wow.
And then Jules Hardy kind of brought it back, but Dr. Wilson added more to it, and what he really sort of took it to a level of his expertise is, you know, by his he was doing the most number of pituitary surgeries, and has done over 3,000 of these operations, probably almost close to 4,000 by the end of his career. And again, what he showed was it's an operation before that helped patients, but now he wanted to push the issues of can we cure tumors and can we do it safely? And those are the two priorities he had, that can we push the limits of cure and can we push the limits of safety? Yeah. And he said he proved that the answer is yes, we can do both.
So he was a visionary not only, but also a technician. His technique must have been
incredible. And you know, the New Yorker did a special article on him about physical geniuses, and they compared him with Yo-Yo Ma and Wayne Gretzky.
I saw that article. It's fascinating.
Interesting. And they went about the aspect of what makes these individuals unique, because there's a lot of people who try to be Wayne Gretzky and Yo-Yo Ma and Charlie Wilson, but they don't get there.
No.
And one of the comments is this 10,000 hour rule, is that if you do something over and over again and you're passionate about it and you're always reevaluating what could be better, that's what leads to perfection, or close to perfection.
Yeah, I think that outlier, it's interesting because I read somewhere where the Beatles, completely different, without the same rule.
Right.
If you play this song enough, you're going to do it just
perfectly
all the time. So that's very interesting. So we will put a link to the New Yorker story when we publish your podcast. We have it already, but I think it's a fascinating, very interesting article. So I want to ask you a little bit about what is it like to be in somebody's head? When I was first diagnosed, I remember looking at the size and I guess you probably remember, I had a pretty sizable adenoma, and when I looked at it, and I looked at actually the anatomy, and I'm looking at where it says in the cella turcica, I wonder if you can tell me what it's like to get in there so small, with so many, you know, critical things going through that area.
I think you have to realize what's so fascinating about pituitary surgeries and just pituitary gland and function is this kidney bean-sized gland that sits at the bottom of the brain in Park Avenue of real estate between the carotid arteries, under the optic nerves, in front of the brainstem, controls all our hormones. And our hormones control our well-being, our metabolism, our emotional state. And it's the transition between the neuronal signals to the body signals that go through this area. So that's one interesting thing. And so that leads to the fact of how important those hormones are in preserving pituitary function is.
Yeah.
The second issue, you're right, it is one of the most technical operations we do, and a very unusual operation. And I think that's where I'm a very a big believer of you have to be a pituitary surgeon to do good pituitary surgery. I always use the analogy of drivers. Neurosurgeons are like drivers. There are a lot of good drivers in the U.S., and they're very good. Uber drivers, we trust our lives with them because we know they're good drivers. But pituitary surgery is not driving a car. It's like driving a car at 150 miles per hour. There's a higher risk to it because it's a different thing. It's not something commonly done. And I would hope if I was in an Uber car, he would never drive 150 miles per hour because I wouldn't trust him.
Sure.
But there are NASCAR drivers who drive 200 miles per hour as a living. And for them, driving 150 miles per hour is routine. They can do it very safely. They do it every day, and they do it repetitively.
Yeah.
And they know what the outcome is going to be. Well, that's kind of pituitary surgery.
Yeah,
you're working through a small area in a very high-risk area. And, you know, there's two options. One is you do the best job possible, which is always our goal. Or two is you do things that may increase risk, which is not fair for the patient, or leave tumor behind, which means more treatment may be necessary.
Yeah.
So again, with pituitary surgery, it's one of those things that it really is a specialty operation.
Yeah. I remember vividly the first time I met you with Dr. Blevins, and you explained to me how you were going to be in a room and you, with your instrumentation, you could get to most of it, but there were corners. And that was a very good analogy, sort of a practical way of visualizing. Yeah. So when you visualize it, you see a bigger, obviously.
Yeah, and that's the important thing is that, you know, what Charlie Wilson showed, and now what we've really performed and really taken it to the next level, is that we could cure a majority of these tumors surgically. The one reason we can't is some of these tumors are invasive and they go into, they wrap around the artery or go into the vein.
Yeah.
Although we can take out tumors from the around the artery and from the vein, cure means we've removed every single cell. If you leave a little crumb behind, it will keep growing or keep making hormones.
Sure.
Once it's invaded that vein, then that's, we can remove the majority but not all the tumor.
Yeah.
But if it hasn't invaded that vein, which fortunately most have not, then we should be able to cure those tumors.
Yeah.
And visualizing that even before the surgery is one of the most important things.
I remember being in some of your endocrine conferences and looking at MRIs, and as a layperson seeing it, just like a map from Mars,
yeah.
And then having you and Dr. Blevins and Dr. Agi explain what you're seeing, and it's so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, we do things a lot of structurally, and one of the things we always do, and I always tell the residents, is that before you do any surgery, you've got to visualize and go through the operation in your mind.
Yeah.
And when you've done something that many times, you can do that. So that way, if I know there's a nubbin of tumor going towards the left, I have to make sure that when I'm doing the surgery, I look towards the left and make sure there's, I've explored that area. And so it's the expectation should be that before you do the surgery, that way when you do the surgery, one, you're less likely to leave tissue behind, and two, you're less likely to get into trouble.
Yeah. So, Dr. Kunowitz, this is absolutely, you know, fascinating. And I wanted to ask you, you are by all counts one of the most successful surgeons in the world, if not in the U.S., in the world. And you're, how do you measure that success?
So I maybe modify that saying. Yeah. I would say yes, but in the world of pituitary surgeries, I would take that credit.
Yeah.
I can't say I'm the best in every field of neurosurgery, but my focus has always been on pituitary surgery. My passion's been there, and I think you know, our focus has been is trying to minimize complications, and I think we've now have one of the lowest complication rates that's ever been published, as well as one of the highest cure rates. So it's doing both. And you know, what we can do is we can take tumors out and cure tumors surgically without damaging the gland, without damaging the artery. Normally, typically, we think about you know, not damaging the artery or the optic nerves, but for us, for me, it's as important to save the gland. If the gland is working, the hormones are functioning, we want to preserve that.
Sure.
So philosophically, the goal is always to remove all the tumor, and there's only a few reasons why we can't, and save all the normal tissue that we can. And so because of that, we've developed a big referral pattern. Of course, now we get to, you know, I think I have the privilege of doing over about 170 surgeries a year, focused just on pituitary surgery.
Wow. Yeah, and I think it's through the patient groups, when you ask, a lot of people say, you want to see a surgeon that at least is doing 50, so they have the experience.
Yeah.
At least 50 a year is the...
Yeah, I'd say 50 to 80 a year, and it's not just the numbers that's important, I think. I think the numbers are important, but, you know, someone can be a bad driver and drive a lot, that doesn't mean he's a good driver. But, so the numbers by themselves are not key. Are they passionate about it? Do they understand the physiology of hormones? Because, again, just as important as of doing surgery is when do we not do surgery. And I think, unfortunately, that's understanding the anatomy and the hormone physiology that can occur.
Yeah, so that's going to be a tough decision when you have to go to a patient and say, we can't do surgery. How do you, that's going to be tough,
I guess. Actually, in some ways it's good. I think patients are always happy to know that they don't need surgery, and that typically happens when they don't have a tumor.
Yeah.
They may have hormonal abnormalities, and they may have a structural abnormality, but again, the story has to make sense. We have patients who have elevated prolactin, for example, difficulty with fertility, and the radiologist read out a tumor. And then I have to go through that and say, well, you know, there is no tumor there. That surgery would be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
And in fact, your elevated hormones are because of something else. For example, there's this phenomenon called macroprolactinemia, where the body makes antibodies against prolactin, causing the prolactin to be elevated. But it's not truly elevated because it's not biologically active.
Yeah.
And the worst scenario would be that individual undergoing surgery because they don't have a pituitary tumor and their prolactin elevation is purely a laboratory finding, not a physiological finding. So that's where we have to be, conclusive about.
Yeah.
The other spectrum, when someone has a very large tumor, which fortunately doesn't happen too often, you're right, it becomes a challenge. Because we still need to treat them. The question is how best to treat them.
Yeah. So you can always do something, but probably so debulking, I guess, is the.
Yeah, and there are times where, you know, again, we're talking about the 1 or 2% of cases where, yeah, we have to do multiple treatments. One treatment alone is not going to be sufficient to get our final goal.
Yeah. So you mentioned you do about 170 plus surgeries a year. Do any of them stand out when you look back? And you, I mean, I won't ask you the whole career, but maybe recent.
Yeah.
Where you say, oh boy, that was an interesting one, or what makes it, I guess, stand out?
Yeah, I think it's hard. They're all so interesting, and no two are ever the same. And you know, and I think the ones that always stand out are the ones that are the more challenging cases. We have one of the largest pediatric populations, and a few weeks ago we did a 4-year-old, and then in a couple of weeks we're doing a 2-year-old. And so you can imagine all the difficulties you'd have in a human body. Shrink that down by 50%, and you're working through a nostril that's about 5 millimeters in size. And of course, complications are bad in any patient, but in kids, we always worry so much more about that.
Sure.
And so those are always the bigger challenges. And it's kind of, you know, we always look at in those situations, boy, this is going to be tough, but boy, doing an operation from above and potential damage to the brain and the blood vessels and the optic nerves, we end up choosing what's the least of the bad ways to approach this. And so those are always challenging. And again, the focus has always been on safety, but still achieving what we need to get to. So those are, they stand out. The other ones are the the ones where sometimes even I am impressed.
Yeah.
We take out this tumor that's large, and I tell the patient we'll probably get 95% of it out. We'll probably have to do some form of radiation therapy afterwards or follow it. And we get the MRI scan afterwards, and the radiologist says there's no tumor left behind. And those are, every once in a while, you give yourself a pat on the back.
Yeah, that's going to be a wonderful feeling.
It is, because there's no question what we do is pretty impressive by all means, but when I can impress myself, it still happens every once in a while.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, I suppose it's because you always anticipate, not problems, but issues. And then when you have a good outcome, it's a great feeling, isn't it?
Yeah,
and you know you're doing it right.
Yeah, so. I think, you know, we've got a database of over, you know, 3,000 patients that, you know, we can go back to. And so we know, I pretty much can predict what the outcome is going to be and you know, what the complications rate may be. And again, we can optimize that. But every once in a while, we think I'm going to leave some behind, and I think it's wrapped around the artery, and it's not, and we can get it all out and cure the patient and save and protect all the normal tissues. That's always a rewarding
outcome. It's interesting from the patient perspective, when you see that, you know, all of the technology and the MRI, just say, boy, they've got to have a very good idea of what's going on, but there's still room for improvement, I'm guessing.
There's always room for improvement. And I think that's one of the things we can never, as surgeons, hang our hats on, is that we do a good job, but we can always do better. And that's always been my philosophy, and that's why we keep pushing the limits. And as you know, now we do pituitary surgeries, well, we do transsphenoidal surgeries, not just for pituitaries, but for other brain tumors, which is a huge advance, is that now we take out hypothalamic tumors, we biopsy optic nerves, we can take out meningiomas or skull-based tumors around the bone in this area, much better than having to go through a craniotomy.
Because it's quite a direct and so less invasive.
No? Yeah, it's a very less invasive approach, and the patient's recovery are 1 or 2 days. And whether I take out a pituitary tumor or a big skull-based tumor or a hypothalamic tumor, which is in the brain, patients still go home after 1 or 2 days.
Well, I remember my case, you know, a day and a half, I was home I remember, don't sneeze. I thought, that's fine. Okay, you know, when the minute you say that to somebody, don't
you feel
sneeze.
Like, you feel like you want to.
Yeah, but anyway, what's interesting.
Yeah.
You can sneeze, obviously.
Yeah, you can.
I don't want people to get worried about
it. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah, no. So, can you tell us a little about the latest techniques that you see? What's coming down the pipe in terms of pituitary surgery and techniques and instrumentation?
Yeah, so, you know, the things that have evolved is one, you know, we've now gone to an endonasal approach. We started that back in 2001. So we've been doing that for about 17 years now, where we don't have to make any incisions. We don't have to use any nasal packing. So patients wake up, they feel like nothing's ever happened other than a runny nose, some congestion, and bad sinus headaches.
Yeah.
So we eliminated the packing. We also do a more anatomy sparing operation now. We don't remove the turbinates. We don't have to reconstruct the back of the sinuses. So there's
what
less.
What are the turbinates?
The turbinates, good question.
Yeah.
They're the sponges that are inside the nose.
Oh, interesting.
Oftentimes, some people take them out to
mm-hmm.
give us some more space
more
to be able to work the room to work in
yeah.
because it's a very small pathway. We do these operations without having to remove any of the turbinates. Sometimes we manipulate the mucosa to be able to develop flaps that can form, which sometimes are necessary. But again, in the majority of patients, we try to preserve the anatomy and make it just like it was before we started. So anatomy preserving procedures are now being performed. We have, of course, adjuvant therapies that are better now. We've got better medical therapies that are coming down the line. For example, Somavert or Pegvisomat,
which is used for
acromegaly, which has been a godsend for patients who have residual disease where we can't fully control the hormones.
Yeah.
We have Gamma Knife now, a very, very focused radiation therapy. It's called radiosurgery, where we have pinpoint accuracy. So if we do leave a piece of tumor left behind in the vein, we can actually draw a line around that and target that with radiation without damaging the gland, the optic nerves, or the brain tissue. And so that's been a huge benefit. Again, getting someone to a curative position.
Yeah.
And of course, the technology even to visualize tumors is better. We use the endoscope now in certain cases where now we can do operations we couldn't do before because we can look around corners and be able to find where the blood vessels are and where the optic nerves are.
Yeah. So there's this, we had, I think Dr. Theodosopoulos that did a podcast for it. He was talking about microscopic and endoscopic or the differences. And I know there's a sort of a debate going on, but it probably depends on when you use. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's an ongoing debate between the endoscope and the microscope. And I think the fundamental issue is that they're both tools. You can put a nail in using a sledgehammer or a hammer. They're both tools. And the question is customizing the operation for the tool necessary? The most important thing, I think, for anatomy preserving is the endonasal approach. We call this, transmenoidal surgery used to be sublabial, which is the incision under the lip, and we lifted the lip up. Mm-hmm. Then it became transnasal, where we made an incision, or transseptal. We made an incision in the nose, and we packing to pack it back down again. Then it transformed to endonasal. That's what I was commenting earlier, that we started that in 2001, where we don't make any incisions or disrupt the mucosa.
Yeah.
We go straight back into the sinuses by making a small window. So that's important because that's what helps patients recover faster.
Sure.
The second important part is what we do when you're there. And what we do when we're there, I think we should never sacrifice this, because there's two ways to take out pituitary tumors. One is to suction and scrape. And we use curettes and ring curettes, which are scraping instruments. We use suction aspiration. And that's how traditionally surgery was. And people like Charlie Wilson, Ed Laws, really, and Ed Oldfield, really showed that sucking and scraping, you're leaving fragments behind.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to debulk tumor. But really, the way to cure a tumor and save the surrounding tissues is to dissect the tumor out. And whether you use the endoscope or the microscope to dissect the tumor out, that's the fundamental goal, the holy grail. And I tell patients, it's like removing the hard-boiled, the egg yolk out of an egg.
Interesting.
If you think about the egg yolk, hard-boiled, imagine a hard-boiled egg, the egg yolk is the tumor and the egg white is the gland. You want to remove all the yellow but not damage any of the white. And you can sit there with a spoon and fork and scrape all the yellow out, and you'll probably leave little yellow pieces everywhere, and you'll probably scrape the white a little bit. Or there's a gray membrane between the egg white and the egg yolk. And that gray membrane is what we call a pseudocapsule. It's a capsule, it's a pseudocapsule around all pituitary tumors. If we can find that separation, and that's part of the skill set and experience, if you find that separation, then you can walk through and take the entire egg yolk out without leaving any yellow behind and without damaging the white.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Now, the difference with most tumors is the egg yolk occupies 90% of the volume, and that egg white is just a thin pancake around it. But still, we can save that thin pancake and remove all the tumor without leaving pieces behind if we micro-dissect the tumor out. So for me, what the endoscope has done is it gives us the ability to look around corners to take out tumors like meningiomas and skull-based tumors in the brain. Unfortunately, I think from my experience is that the microscope is still best for pituitary tumors. And there's never, our cure rates and our complication rates are as good and actually even slightly better when we use the microscope than with the endoscope.
Yes.
And that's been sort of the trend that we've seen.
I
think the general consensus is that everyone will adhere to is that an endoscope makes a bad surgeon better, but a good surgeon can use either. And it's just a matter of, for me, what's best for the patient.
Sure.
If my goal is to cure a pituitary tumor and save the gland, a microscope is better. It's kind of operating with two eyes, it's three-dimensional imaging.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than the eyeball as far as resolution is concerned. Any camera-based system is 4K is very, very good,
yeah,
but still not as good as
your eye.
I can watch a 40 Warriors game on TV, but there's no better experience than actually being there.
Oh,
you see,
no doubt.
Three-dimensional, you can
sure,
see
that's
everything
a great
with
analogy.
Complete clarity.
Yeah.
It's a better experience overall.
Yeah.
So if I want to remove a pituitary tumor, I can always remove it using a microscope, and we can get great cure rates and lower minor risks. The big major risks are good either way,
yeah,
but the minor risks of preserving the gland or not causing diabetes insipidus oftentimes are better when you have that three-dimensional approach with the microdissection.
Yeah.
With the endoscope, though, what I use it for is when I have craniopharyngiomas, which are oftentimes in younger patients that extend into the brain and can wrap around the optic nerves or the carotid arteries, I need to see where those structures are. So then I do need to look around corners.
Yeah.
When I do meningiomas, for example, transsphenoidally, I think we can't do those without using the endoscope. So for me, they're both tools. And
yeah,
sometimes I need a hammer and sometimes I need a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
But I don't believe in the process of using a sledgehammer for everything. And unfortunately, what the endoscope has transformed into is a marketing tool. But in the end, it doesn't make a difference whether you use the endoscope or the microscope, as long as your goals are to remove 100% of the tumor, if we can, and preserve the gland, which should always be
yeah,
the priority.
Yeah, I think it would be fascinating if we ever get the opportunity to show, you know, through a video what how it works. I know we've seen, and we have published videos, but they're so difficult for the layperson to understand the anatomy and what's going on, even though some of them are very good.
Yeah, one of the other thing that is different is with the endoscope, what the observer sees, what the audience sees, is what the surgeon sees. It's beautiful anatomy.
Yeah.
You can see three dimensions. You can see everything in one image. With the microscope, it's much more focused, but that's how we do surgery. We can see carotid to carotid, but we don't operate on both carotids at the same time. We operate on one side, then we operate on the other side.
Yeah, when you have to put an instrument so thin between I can't remember what you call this.
The dissectors or the curettes.
Yeah, the yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I think the issue there is what the surgeon sees is very different, because what the surgeon sees is three-dimensional. When we look through a microscope, the surgeon sees everything.
Yeah.
The observer sees 50% and the audience sees 50% of that. So the view is different than what the surgeon sees.
I'm
what
sure.
The surgeon sees
so that's what would be so fascinating to be able to see
which is
what you
see. Hard to duplicate
yeah.
because
I
the technology
imagine.
Doesn't exist. It's
yeah.
like no matter how good of a 4K camera you have, being in a Warriors game is very different than watching
sure,
it on a flat
sure.
screen TV.
I totally get the analogy.
The other thing that you have to keep in mind for me is that, you know, the space is limited. And so when you have a 12 millimeter or 15 millimeter channel, to put a 4 millimeter endoscope takes up 30% of your working
yeah.
space. And again, if you need it, we use it. But for pituitary tumors, I've never found a huge utility. Is because what you end up doing, actually, people have the perception that the endoscope is less invasive. Actually, it's not. I mean, the endonasal approach is less invasive.
Yeah.
But the endoscope, oftentimes, you do have to take a turbinate, or you do have to make a wider opening because there's more instruments to try to get down there. Patients don't. I mean, in the end, it probably has a very little impact in patients.
Yeah.
But the perception of being less
yeah,
invasive is not
true. Because
when you
go to a mechanic, you really don't ask him, fix my car. You don't say, well, you're going to use a wrench or a hammer.
Exactly.
I don't care. Just fix the car.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think they're both good tools. Unfortunately, I think the endoscope has been used as a marketing tool.
Yeah, interesting.
But for me, it doesn't make a difference what you use. What really makes a difference is that we're sparing the anatomy, so that helps prevent long-term complications with sinuses. And the most important thing, is that we do the right operation, which
yeah.
is that if we can cure the tumor, we should cure it. And as important as curing the tumor is preserving whatever hormones still work.
And I'm assuming now you're getting patients from all over the world that are referred coming to.
We are. We have patients from Hong Kong and from Chile and
yeah.
from India. And
yeah.
I think a lot of the European patients probably go more to the East Coast programs, but
yeah.
more the Asian and South American
yeah.
programs. And then I think the most things that, you know, we always want to get patients to understand is that it's always okay to get a second opinion.
Yeah.
You know, one of the, and I never fault a surgeon who doesn't drive 150 miles per hour to stop driving at 90 miles per
yeah.
hour. So that means they do the operation, but they leave some tumor behind. That's a quality surgeon, because
sure.
he knew his limits and he stopped
before
it became dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
With that said, that's why about almost 20% of the surgeries we do are redo surgeries, because tumor was left behind or the tumor came back in an area that we can surgically cure still. And that's still okay. I mean, I'd rather do that. Of course, it's always better to cure this patient the first time around.
Yeah.
But at least as long as they understand that. Yeah. So, you know, getting second opinions and then trying to understand why we're doing what we're doing is always okay for patients to do. It's never going to offend a surgeon. I recommend other patients that are complicated to get second opinions.
Yeah.
But I think the key thing is, you know, like I mentioned before, is that pituitary surgery is a specialty practice, and it should be done by people who have a lot of experience in it, a lot of passion in it. And I think the most important thing for patients is to feel comfortable with their surgeon. If they feel comfortable with their surgeon, then that's probably the
that's critical. The I can tell you, for me, it was critical. Relaxing. Well, not relaxing, but I mean, what's the word?
Brain, this brain surgery is never relaxing.
You know, yeah. But it was just so reassuring.
Yeah.
You know, that's okay. These guys know what they're doing. You know, it was evident.
Right.
Thanks so much.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So but you know, this going back just offline. I mean, well, about this issue of the endoscope and the microscope, it's an ongoing debate. And I will say one of the frustrating things of medicine is that people are doing these courses on the weekend, learning how to do endoscopic surgery, and then promoting that's what they do in the community. Unfortunately, learning a course over a weekend does not make you a pituitary surgeon.
No, and that's where you get to do a lot of fixing, I'm sure.
That's where we do a lot of fixing, and also that's where we see some complications.
Yeah.
And people have patients have the perception that the endoscope is a better tool. It has its advantages. It's critical in certain situations, but again, not necessary for everything.
Yeah.
And one of the things we teach, actually, is that in order to get experience and comfort factors with using an endoscope, we have to do it a lot. And so you do it a lot on patients you don't need to use it on.
Yeah.
But that's not fair for pituitary patients.
No.
For patients who have a craniopharyngioma or a meningioma, they need that expertise with the endoscope. But if you have a 12-millimeter pituitary tumor, you don't need an endoscope to cure that. In fact, it's more traumatizing, it takes longer, and the minor complication rates are slightly higher.
Yeah.
So it's a little unfair for that patient to be experimental, but to have a surgeon training how to use an endoscope so he can use the endoscope in bigger operations. I think, again, they're tools, and you have to use it when it's appropriate.
It comes to light, some that, you know, 10,000-hour analogy that you used, because you can't substitute for that.
You can't, and again...
And in this case, you can't learn it unless you're doing it.
Yeah, and I think the hard part is that if we've got... You know, again, I think there's, you know, studies to show this, is that it definitely makes a bad surgeon better.
Yes.
But a good surgeon is what you want to be.
Exactly.
And so once you become a good pituitary surgeon, whether you use the microscope and you can cure tumors with low complications, you use the endoscope where you can cure tumors and have low complications, they're both tools. But one is not more, both could be done minimally invasive. Both can be done where there's no packing in the nose and there's very little trauma. But in our experience, you know, patients actually sometimes do better with the microscope, but sometimes you have to use the endoscope because that's the only tool that allows us to do what we want to accomplish.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
It's evolving. It's evolving.
Yeah.
And
it's
interesting
from the patient standpoint, because you read it, obviously we read it with a lot less understanding.
Right.
Sometimes the way things are packaged or, you know, for consumption or not, it's not that they're not accurate, it's just that they're spun.
So they are.
I'm sure the explanation part is.
Yeah, and you have to read behind the. It's like when you always worry when a company sponsors something and says the outcomes are such, because there's always going to be conflict of interest.
Sure.
And
sure.
How do you sort of read behind the lines? And that's where studies come in handy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where you can look at a study, looking at things where either it's hard to randomize in this field, but you can look at comparative analysis. But also look at, again, is there a conflict of interest involved?
Yeah.
And there's no question,
even
the endoscope is improving. 3D endoscopes exist now, so we can get that three-dimensional imaging, but the visual quality is less. So we've improved one part, but now we've lost a little bit of the quality of image. The second thing is the tools are improving, where, as I said, now we will get to a point where with the endoscope we can dissect rather than just suck and scrape, because sucking and scraping is good for making the MRI scans look good.
Yeah.
But it's not good for curing patients.
Yeah.
Because leaving fragments
behind
is where tumors
come
back.
Yeah.
So all these things have to be looked at and played out.
Yeah.
But I think the bottom line is is when we can, we should cure these tumors, and always we should, you know, minimize complications.
How fast is the technology moving, like the visualizing technology? Because you look at how technology moves, it moves in some areas at 1,000 miles an hour.
So when you're looking at cell phones, it moves very, very slowly.
Yeah.
Cell phones change every 2 years. When you look at medicine, it's actually moving fast. I mean, it evolves over a decade, and for us, that's pretty fast. So biomedical evolution is very different than IT evolution.
Sure.
IT evolves every year to every 2 years. Biomedical innovation usually is over decades.
Yes.
And so it's a different time scale.
I can imagine.
Yeah, but it is moving forward.
Yeah, and I'm assuming a lot of research going on too, in the instrumentation.
In the instrumentation, and also the genetics of these tumors, and trying to understand why these tumors develop, and then perhaps even, can we redevelop gland tissue? I mean, you know, is there ability, instead of replacing hormones, to regrow gland? I mean, that would be the holy grail. So that way, any hormones lost because of the tumor, we try not to lose hormones because of the surgery. We should, in theory, that should never happen, or it should be minimal. But unfortunately, as the tumor grows, the hormones are lost because of loss of compression of the gland. And the gland doesn't regenerate in a normal individual, but can we promote the gland to regenerate? And that's another really exciting area of research.
I can imagine. And is that moving fast or
no? That's still going to be about maybe a decade to two decades from now. Yeah,
like the immunotherapies. That's also, I mean, I know there's a lot of research and talk about that, but it's moving faster. But it's still a ways away.
Immunotherapy has made groundbreaking in the last 5 years now. I'd say with CAR T therapy for lymphomas has been groundbreaking. For cancer therapy, but realize immunotherapy started in the early 70s. So to get here, it took 45 years. So it takes, you know, so if we think about it, wow, this is great, immunotherapy is working. We've been working on this since the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
So it takes time.
And
I think with, you know, regeneration of the gland, again, people are starting to work on it, but it's going to take time, but I think we will get there.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
Oh, it's wonderful.
The work you guys do is great, because I think information, one of the biggest advantage to social media and to data, there's a lot of disadvantages I can talk about with bullying and everything else.
We have challenges.
But the huge is getting information out there. And I think that's, you know, information, you know, provides strength to patients and is a very powerful tool.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good. It's been a very interesting experience for me. To do it, because if you would have asked me 10, 15 years ago, what are you going to be doing when you're in your mid-60s, the last thing I would have done is publishing a pituitary magazine.
Online magazine.
I didn't even know anything about the pituitary gland. It's fascinating. I can see how, you know, how interesting it is.
I got to tell you, it's great to bring vision back to people who've lost vision. It's even more exciting to bring back fertility to women who've lost fertility.
Yeah.
And of course, it's great to be able to, you know, if we can cure tumors, and so patients, you know, ideally don't have to do any additional therapies if we can.
Well, thank you so much. This has been fascinating. I'm sure our audience is going to be thrilled to listen to you explain how you do things and how you feel about things, which is really interesting and fun to listen to.
It's my pleasure. I mean, I've kind of, it's been my passion, and I commit a lot of my time, resources, because I love doing, you know, pituitary surgery.
You have to, and it shows.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so important to love what you do, because you spend so much time doing it. No?
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask you this. I know every profession has their, you know, their ups and downs. So is there anything that keeps you up at night in your profession?
I think, you know, every night that what keeps me up is thinking about the cases the next day, you know.
And I can imagine. And I
do that because I think it's, no matter how, no operation becomes routine. And no matter how many times I do the surgery, there's always variations. And you need to be aware of those. And so one of the things I always teach, and one of the things I always practice, and my mentor did this as well, is to live the operation before you do it. And that's what I do the night before.
That's critical. No?
Every case I'm going to do the next day, I think about the anatomy, I think about what I expect. And if you play that in your mind first, then when you're actually doing the surgery, you stay out of trouble, and you, I think your outcomes are always better.
Yeah.
So that's what keeps me up at night.
I can imagine that. I was going to ask if you were able to compartmentalize them. When you go home, because it's such a sometimes difficult, you know, when you're this.
And I got to say, I've got the most wonderful wife, because she realized work is not work for me, it's my life.
Yeah.
So it's, if you enjoy what you do, it's not work anymore. And
yeah.
So the borders of what my work is and my life is really melt together. And so I don't compartmentalize it. It's my life,
yeah.
Really. And she understands that.
That's great. Well, thank you again. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Pituitary World News, as you know, is totally free of charge and is supported by donations and contributions from people like you and companies that, just like you, believe in our mission to increase awareness, improve quality of life, and reduce the number of undiagnosed and misdiagnosed people with debilitating disease. So if you'd like to donate, any amount works, really, and it will be truly appreciated. Simply go to pituitaryworldnews.org to get to our donation space page and click on Get Involved at the top of the page. Thank you so much, and as always, your donation is fully tax deductible. Thank you for listening.